This episode of Subaltern Speaks is a sequel of my previous interview with Professor Victor Rivas on the origins and characteristics of the syncretic Venezuelan cult of Maria Leonza, which combines African, indigenous Venezuelan, and Catholic beliefs. In this episode, Professor Rivas and I discuss Maria Leonza's immense influence in shaping Venezuela's post-colonial national and spiritual identity in the 20th century, and how her worship is a microcosm for other movements which seek to decolonize indigenous spiritualities from oppressive and discriminatory structures. I wanted to talk more about Maria Leonza as a symbol of modern-day post-colonial Venezuela, and basically her significance in the society there. So given how our podcast is centered on topics of decolonization, I wanted to talk about Maria Leonza's role in decolonizing Venezuelan spirituality and how her growth in popularity has provided Venezuelans an alternative to basically the Catholic Church, which is the established religion and eminent source of guidance, not just in Venezuela, of course, in all Latin America. So to get us started on that, I mean, you already mentioned, you talked a lot about syncretism and what it is. I just wanted to ask you, why do you think it took such a hold in Latin America in general?
So at the outset, why Latin America? Well, Latin America would have been that crossroads, right? So you get the idea of a place where you're having the confluence of minimum three very influential cultures. I keep stating that the Asian contribution tends to be left out, but for the purposes of talking about Maria Leonza and many other similar expressions of religiosity, Latin America is the crossroads of the three principal cultures that make up the majority of the population of Latin America: the Europeans and their descendants, the indigenous original peoples of the territories we're calling Latin America, and then the African descendants of the forced slavery migration, right? So you have this confluence of these racialized groups, and it is during the time where these groups were being racialized. So not only during colonial times, but most prominently the 18th and particularly the 19th century, where the groups are so racialized that in reaction, to talk about the post-colonial aspect, in reaction to the movements of independence, because we have to understand that the territories we call Latin America today, the modern nations, were previous colonies of not only the Empire of Spain, but you have Brazil. There was the colony of the Empire of Portugal. So Portugal and Spain as empires had holdings, colonial territories all over the world, including in Asia. But why this one in particular? In Latin America then, in the beginning of the 19th century, the movements of independence are occurring. Here's where Simón Bolívar comes into play again. And the different people, societies in Latin America, from Mexico all the way down to the southern cone of Argentina and Chile, and everything in between, are essentially taking a chance to rebel, to go against the monarchy of Ferdinand VII at the beginning of the 19th century, to take advantage of a historical of historical takeover by Joseph Bonaparte of the Hispanic Peninsula. And in doing so, these different nations, in the case of South America, led by Bolívar in the north, San Martín in the south, they are calling for a differentiation. That is, what does it mean to be American versus being the cousins or the subjects of Spain, or the American cousins of the peoples of Spain? So they want to differentiate themselves. So right there you begin a process of identification that will definitely mark the difference between being American, Spanish American, versus being from the peninsula, from from Spain itself. And you're right, right. And so in that process, at the beginning of the independence movement, add to that now that after the independence movements are successful at different moments and they start becoming the original nations that we understand and we know today, Venezuela separate, eventually Colombia separate, Argentina separate, Mexico separate, they will in fact start to establish their own national histories. If up to that point, the official histories were always favoring the European, in particular the Spanish accounts of the events of history, at this point where they're now reinventing themselves, right? In the 19th century, they will now start pushing that Spanish history a little bit to the side and saying, hey, let's go back and let's rescue our original history. That is, let's start to recognize our indigenous past. In that process, they did leave out the descendants of the African communities and the population, even though in some cases there were very important figures that contributed to the movements of independence. But that process of identification of the African element is not going to happen until later in the 19th century, a little bit later. There's still a lot of resistance, cultural resistance, to that acknowledgement. There's even a problem here. There's even a problem that is extremely controversial.
It seems as if like in the Latin American context, basically the elites, a lot of like the criollo elites, but the word criollo basically means Spaniards, like ethnically Spaniards, but born in the Americas and mostly of like Spanish blood, they were way more comfortable with having like indigenous peoples like incorporated into their history. But somehow when it came to Africans, it was like, oh, that's different. And they were, I guess, they had a different, a completely different reaction to that. Which I find very interesting how they were much more willing to accept the indigenous incorporate them, than the Africans. Yes,
that is true. But then you see many efforts that also occur towards the end of the 19th century and then the beginning of the 20th, and follow suit throughout the 20th century, where they're trying then very, very hard to incorporate the participation and the importance of the African descendants in the different regions of Latin America into their national histories. So that is occurring. And we see that, though, in the cult of María Leonza. María Leonza, as it's then understood and began to be represented and then studied, as we said earlier, towards the beginning of the 20th century, where you had serious scientific, anthropological studies of this expression of religiosity. They started noticing that there were images, that not only drawings, paintings, but he also had busts, perhaps a carved piece of wood that would be painted to represent the indigenous and the criollo, and then also the African. And so you would see these representations. That's why you have these three powers, or the tres potencias. They do represent the ethnic makeup, the racial or racialized makeup of the nation, not only of Venezuela, but of Latin America as a whole. So then the religion itself, again, always being evolving, its syncretic characteristic, being pushed at every turn, at every different stage of history and cultural change. Case in point, the incorporation of the Viking court, once these ideas and narratives start becoming part of the history of the Americas at large. So the Vikings do come to the Americas. We understand that as a story that precedes now Columbus. Now that has to be incorporated belatedly, right, towards the end of the 20th century, to the narrative of what it does it mean to be Latin America. So this religion, this cult, appeals to the larger population. You don't stop being Christian, you don't stop being a particular Catholic as a Venezuelan, but you are also on the side, get to on the specific dates or specific needs, you get to also add this belief system to your tools, to your toolkit of belief systems. So you don't cease being Catholic, you don't cease being a Christian, but a caveat, so here's a warning, the cult of Maria Leonza is called a cult because the official stance of the church, the Catholic Church from the Vatican, and all the people who are part of that system, so the priests that are in Venezuela as well, do not recognize this form or expression of religiosity as a religion. That's why they prefer to continue using the term cult.
I mean, you already answered a question I wanted to ask, which was like, what's the stance of the Catholic Church on Maria Leonza? And as you said, well, they don't recognize it. That's why they call it a cult. And it's also how like the power of language has. So by calling it cult, they quickly like marginalize it. They quickly push it to the side. But if they call it a religion or a religion, or that's like something. That's too much. Yeah, it's too much, giving too much credit to it, basically. So they say, oh, it's a cult, it's a culto or something like that. But on the political side, so that's the spiritual realm. The chiefs in the Catholic Church don't accept it. But as I was personally looking, researching, and I know Hugo Chavez because I lived in Latin America. I had a lot of Venezuelan friends. I remember Hugo Chavez. He was a very spirited man. He had very strong opinions, and I certainly remember him basically questioning the conquest of Latin America by the Spanish. He basically challenged that, and he actually directly, he like called it out as being a genocide and as being a crime against humanity, and even so much so that he even changed the day, basically what is Columbus Day in the United States, or what we know as Columbus Day in North America. Traditionally in Latin America, it was called Dia de la Raza, Day of the Race, but he changed it to Dia de la Resistencia Indígena, the Day of the Indigenous Resistance, which I found incredibly, back in, I guess it was in 2004, around that time. And I just thought, wow, Hugo Chavez was, I mean, I know this is a very controversial topic because I know given the circumstances in Venezuela, a lot of Venezuelans have strong opinions about him and his legacy. But putting that aside, he was very ahead of his time, because us here in North America, we're just dwelling on these questions of reconciliation, of, you know, with the movements like Black Lives Matter, we're questioning the historical legacies of Europeans that came here and put these institutions that now we have in Canada, in the United States. And we're kind of questioning that, and we're kind of challenging the narrative. But he was doing that back in 2004, when there was no Black Lives Matter. There was no talks of reconciliation with the Aboriginal people, as we do here in Canada, at least. There was none of that, but he was already putting these questions forth in Venezuela, in Latin America. So I basically wanted to ask your opinions on that, how Hugo Chavez basically changed the worship of Maria Leonza. Did he kind of did he allow for it to be practiced more publicly, for example? Or did he give a major popularity boost to Maria Leonza?
Yes. So again, the complexities to understanding Maria Leonza and the practice of her religion, of her cult, and the practitioners, who they are and why they do what they do, go into so many different questions, so many aspects. In this particular case, political. If you recall, just a moment ago, I was talking about Juan Vicente Gómez at the turn from the 19th to the 20th century, our first 20th century dictator. and a strongman. He was a military strongman. So it depends on the point of view. You can see where this person, this particular historical character of Juan Vicente Gómez, was positive or negative for the country. Again, depends on your point of view. You actually had intellectuals, full-fledged intellectuals, being apologists for the caudillo, this military strongman, holding the position of president for decades at the beginning of the 20th century in Venezuela. And then it is these same intellectuals, one in particular, who is promoting the idea that that the government under Juan Vicente Gómez should allow for the practice and for this belief system, in particular towards María Leonza, to be practiced. It should not be banned. It should not be censored. In the 1950s, here you have another military dictator, General Marcos Pérez Jiménez, who for a decade holds the presidency under a dictatorship. And then he also allows and promotes the idea that Venezuelans in general, the whole population, are free to worship such a cult, right? Even though you're going to church, you're going to the cathedral, you're going to the local churches, you're also still practicing on the side. You're making maybe a pilgrimage to the mountain of Sorte in Yaracuy. And so again, remember that Marcos Pérez Jiménez in the 50s is the one who commissioned the statue that we talked about earlier. So it becomes more of a public deity, right? And so that tacit recognition, that tacit permission, allowance of the image to be so publicly displayed in the center of Caracas and the capital, it's like saying to the rest of the nation and those believers and adepts of María Leonza that, hey, it's okay, go for it. Move now to the 90s, and you have that situation where Lieutenant Colonel Hugo Chavez tries to do the attempted coups against Carlos Andrés Pérez. And then suddenly Chavez is tied in to the populace, to the popularity. He becomes so popular that even while he's in jail, responding for the crime of attempted overthrow, right, of a coup attempt against a democratically elected government. It doesn't matter if the government wasn't popular, it was just still a crime, political crime. He's in jail, and at that time, people start incorporating special praise and special prayers and orations to the living character, the living being of Hugo Chavez. That he starts developing his own, people call it a cult of personality. And that happens, and that leads to the elections in 98, 99. He's reelected, a new constitution, and then the era of Chavez begins, 99, then in 2000. So it is, you're right, when you bring up that Chavez was very forward-thinking in terms of decolonizing the status quo. What does it mean to decolonize the status quo? You begin with different aspects of cultural practice, what we call the everyday practice, our system of education, our law, system of law, the way in which we consider the different strata in society, the poor, the middle class, the elite or the rich, and then of course the minus 1%. But you start reconsidering these aspects. You start reconsidering what does it mean to know? What is knowledge? And so in all of these issues, President Chavez's controversial government was in fact going against the grain of the status quo of Western culture, Western democracies, United States in particular, and did not see eye to eye with the way in which the United States in particular were practicing their politics in relation to the rest of Latin America. There's a long history of interventions. There's a long history of influence that we don't have to go into right now. I think that your audience will understand this, but nonetheless, the media did portray Chavez as being extremely controversial, and it doesn't matter on which side of the political fence one stands then and now. But the fact is that Chavez did bring in a lot of cultural changes to not only Venezuela, but to the region, to Latin America as a whole. In doing that, you mentioned, Yasemin, the change of how in the culture we celebrated the 12th of October. So October 12th, as you said, the day of race, el Día de la Raza, that idea of celebrating those three particular racialized groups that we talked about earlier, right? European, indigenous, and African descent in the Americas. El Día de la Raza was supposed to celebrate these confluences and their contributions to each other. By the time Chavez decrees the change of the name and the way in which we celebrate and the consciousness, the political and social consciousness that we should, and it decolonize and practice, reconsider what the 12th of October means and what do those meetings and contributions of the three particular racialized groups means to us. It's not that we owe everything to the Europeans, as official history wanted us to celebrate, but rather we should take more into account the effects of the so-called encounter. That's a problematic term too, because encounter would presuppose that the indigenous people wanted to have this encounter. But this confluence of these three groups over time, and given the different tragic histories as well, nonetheless, here we are. Here we are for the past 500 years, practically. We are a different group, a different identity. And in a decolonizing move at the beginning of this 21st century, to rethink the events of the 12th of October and all that that means historically is to consider the idea, the notion that there was a genocidal event that followed Columbus's historical crossing of the Atlantic. That is the conquest and the colonization of the territories that once were of the indigenous peoples of the Americas. Add to that, the story of the African diaspora, of the slave trade. Right? So that's how we begin to decolonize. There are many other elements of the María Alianza cult or religion that can be used also to decolonize. Not only does it recognize those three racialized groups, as you saw in the representation of the Tres Potencias, right, the three powers, but you also have stories that are now being recuperated, if you wish, rescued. And they're incorporated anew into the changing syncretic representations of the cult or religion of María Alianza. One of them was the idea of the Vikings being part of the Latin American story. Another one is, let's look at the liberating court, the court of the liberators, of which Simón Bolívar is the head. Now they've incorporated not only Juan Vicente Gómez, already mentioned, right, but also we're seeing representations of Hugo Chávez as being now the latest member of that court of the liberators, not only of Venezuela, but of Latin America. So there's a rethinking there. There's an incorporation there, right, of the controversial figure of Chávez, at least by the populace, by those people who are participating in this form of religiosity that is María Alianza, by actually incorporating Hugo Chávez, they're saying quite out loud, they're saying, hey, he is a worthy member of that liberating court, of the court of liberators. He is there in company and led by Simón Bolívar.
I was wondering, like, that to what extent has, like, Venezuelans themselves, like, maybe within their education system, within, like, their popular culture, how has their perceptions of their own history and towards the Spaniards changed? Or has it there even been a change ever since, like, Chavez came? Because, I mean, you mentioned that he transformed the society in his, I don't know, not even 20 years. Mm-hmm. Years he was in power. He died in 2013. So yeah, about 15 years. So how did that change the perspective of Venezuelans towards themselves and who they are as a people and their culture and their mm-hmm. Spanish colonization?
Right. So to speak about the legacy of Chavez, going in a direction that is quite different. It is also related to Maria Leonza. So Chavez, his main contribution was to make the population aware of each other and aware of the differentiation of the social classes, and that the poor, or if you wish, poverty, was racialized. Poverty was typically a topic that would be approached as, well, we do have a lot of poor people in Venezuela and Latin America in general, but the poor are people from all different races, if you wanted to racialize it in that sense. But the reality in numbers, the reality of people with feet on the ground doing their surveys and talking to the population, and just simply the fact, if you go to Venezuela and you go to the poor areas, the visual reality is that the majority of the poor are the descendants of the African slaves in Venezuela, along with the indigenous, and depending on how we talk about the indigenous, those who are still remaining and who will continue to remain in their traditional places, of if the indigenous people have not been a part of the urban realities, if they have not come to these cities and then incorporated themselves either as part of that fabric of society or as, quote, citizens, quote, unquote. And this is a very controversial point that's been 200 years in the making. Chavez made a point that he actually put into the Constitution, where there are large sections that give the rights in a Constitution to the indigenous peoples, the protection of the indigenous peoples of Venezuela. More than 30 different ethnic groups recognized in Venezuela. The numbers used to be larger, but the representative speakers or practitioners of the culture have since died away. So the numbers are dwindling. But to recognize up to the point of 30 different ethnic groups in Venezuela that have a constitutional right is one of the legacies of Hugo Chavez. He also promoted the idea that Afro-Venezolanidad, to be an Afro-Venezuelan and their culture, must also be protected and not pay so much attention to the cultures that are coming from outside. Primarily, the cultural hegemony is held by the United States, right? Talk about Hollywood, talk about films, and TV programs, and you name it, products. So the United States and then Europe. So it is not a question, Chavez would say, it's not a question of ignoring or discarding the Western contributions from Europe and from the United States, but to not let that override our national, our autochthonous, our local cultures, which include the racialized aspects of the culture. So Chavez brought in a consciousness, a social consciousness, that was meant to take notice of the racialized poor in the majority, the descendants of African slaves and mixed in with indigenous populations as well, the urban mestizos and all the different groups. So Chavez brings this to the population's attention, and that becomes a problem for a group that, if we want to talk about criollos, or people who were holding power, also racialized, because the majority tended to be descendants of the Europeans in one way or another, even mestizos, who highly prefer the criollo characterization. So power was held by people who were essentially white in Venezuela. If you were to put up a portrait of all the presidents, starting with Simón Bolívar, José Antonio Páez after him, all the presidents, all the way up to Hugo Chávez, they'll all be white, older white men. Chávez is the first person who looks like the rest of the people of Venezuela. He is essentially, what one would consider the son of María Leonza, of Mama Inés, Afro-Venezuelan, and Simón Bolívar. He is the child of those three different groups.
Yeah, of basically the tres potencias, basically. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. And that tres potencias then symbolically, just representationally, you see those tres potencias already described racially, and they represent that population of Venezuela. That is part also one of the big appeal of the Court of María Leonza to the Venezuelan population. I just want to add one more little aspect that I think it's important to point out in terms of decolonizing practices. If you consider that the Catholic Church has been the institution, the religious institution that was controlling from the onset, from the colonial times, throughout independence and then after independence, the very in a very influential way, the makeup or the fabric of in particular Venezuelan society and other Latin American nations as well. In the 19th century, it was hard fought to separate church from state. Again, one of those liberal ideas that the conservatives and liberals were fighting for in their civil wars in the 19th century, trying to determine how to self-govern. The liberal idea at the time was this idea of, one of it was the idea of separation of church and state. And the church had been seen even towards the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century in different parts of Latin America as still a major culprit that kept the marginalized populations in poverty, that kept the indigenous in particular and the descendants of the African population, most notably, in poverty, that is, lack of access to education and to educational systems, that their policies the Catholic Church controlled. This is a controversial statement, but it is a fact that was fought over in the 19th century creation of the nations, the modern nations, and then in the beginning of the 20th century, still a lot of criticism from intellectuals. In the case of Peru, you have José Carlos Mariátegui advocating for the indigenous peoples. In the 1920s, he's advocating for the right of the indigenous peoples to have education, to have access to education, to participate in the general makeup of this social fabric of the nation. Whereas the church would say, no, we got to keep them at bay. We got to, because they're not going to learn. And they still had a very retrograde stance towards marginalized populations that are particularly indigenous and the African descendants. This is the problem with the church at the beginning of the 20th century. So you can see then how different governments, depending on their views politically throughout the 20th century and ending with Chávez and now Maduro, the different stances that they might have had against the Catholic Church and how the Catholic Church might have reacted to any of their own policies, especially in the last 20 years, the Catholic Church and Chávez locked horns a lot of times. And it has to do with this long history of how the Catholic Church was influential on society. And to your question earlier about how the different governments might have allowed or disallowed, depending, you can see this in practice, many governments in Venezuela allowed the practice of María Leonza and others disallowed it. And again, for different reasons, incorporating the population into the national participation, right, of society, or appeasing the different belief systems of the population, or making the population identify with different racialized groups and then belief systems, and or even becoming sympathetic with the general population. And we're not talking about the criollos or the elite, right? The 1%, we're talking about the middle class, and then below the middle class, the general big real numbers of Venezuelan population. So these are the groups that are being spoken to and then having conversations with regarding the allowance of the court of Maria Leonza.
Right. Well, to conclude, I mean, I have one more question to ask you. Given the current milieu we are in and the increased interest and awareness about the destructive colonial legacies on conquered peoples, or some would say subaltern peoples, and especially in academia, also in the mainstream, do you think there is a substantial value in studying Latin America's syncretic religions, particularly in our case, Maria Leonza? Do you think it like sheds light on subaltern voices or helps us better interpret Latin American history in less Eurocentric ways? What's your opinion on that? Do you think there needs to be more research, essentially, especially in the English-speaking world or even Spanish? Right,
I agree 100% that more attention and more research that would help the world population, not only here in the West, North American academia, European academia, but in general, just disseminate and share these findings about what these different religious expressions mean. Because in a lot of cases, such as in the case of Maria Leonza in particular, you will see that the makeup, that is the components, the different parts that make up the religion, are definitely representatives of marginalized or subaltern groups. In this case, we have been speaking about the indigenous populations, their myths, how that's been incorporated into the cult or religion of Maria Leonza, and the descendants of the African population, the descendants of the slave trade, in particular in Venezuela, being a Caribbean nation, and how these groups, the Afro-Venezuelans, incorporated a lot of their practices, borrowed, taken in from their own diverse groups from Africa. Also the groups that created their own expressions in the Caribbean, in particular in Cuba. Here we refer to Santeria, right? And we referred to, earlier you brought up Candomblé, and many different other syncretic expressions and syncretic religions that are meant to incorporate, that is, their very nature is that of incorporating all the different points of views, especially of the marginalized or the subaltern groups of a population. These are groups that are called marginalized or subaltern because they were excluded from the general a construction of the legal aspects of society, the civic aspects of society, right? What does it mean to be a citizen of a nation? And only the haves, only the criollos, only the elite would have access to the concept of being a citizen. Then, thus leaving out the rest who we identify as the marginalized or the subaltern.
Wow.
So yes, we definitely need to look at other expressions. Hopefully, in the future, show you can have somebody talking about Santeria, most definitely.
Oh yes, yeah. So if we can conclude this, thank you so much, Professor Rivas, for your time that you put in this, and to come here and speak to me about these topics is definitely extremely valuable. Thank you for so much for your time, and have a great day, Professor Rivas.
Thank you for inviting me. Thank you so much, Yasmin. And it was a pleasure to be here.